So what we're doing this morning for Education Hour ties in with Matthew 24, with the Olivet Discourse. So let's turn there. If we look at the third verse of Matthew 24, we have the disciples' questions to Jesus after they had just pointed the temple buildings and all that. And he says, hey, one stone's not going to lift on another. Things coming down. And then he goes off to the Mount of Olives, and they ask him some questions about that. Or at least provoked by that, we could say, at very least. That's verse 3. He sat on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And those are the questions that provoke, or at least begin, the Olivet Discourse. And I've tried to argue, for these kind of long weeks, long scattered weeks, as it turns out, that the first half of the Olivet Discourse has to do with these things, when will these things be, which is to say the destruction of Jerusalem, and particularly the temple. And then as Jesus gives that as a near, one which has signs that are, there are these kind of proximate signs of wars and so on, the specific signs of Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. When this happens, that's a parousia, that's a coming of Jesus Christ. That's the word we're looking at this morning, parousia. And it's specifically mentioned that way if you're looking down the Olivet Discourse. And I got to tell you, it's interesting, preparing out of one Bible but then teaching out of another makes problems. He's trying to find it. So when it comes to, no one knows the day or the hour. So before that, oh, come on, Tim. Yes, sir. Might as well fire a question away.
So, maybe contrary to dispositionalism, what were the disciples, do you think, thinking when they said, end of the age? Were they thinking in terms of a particular, as you might lay it out, time frame?
Good. So, that's good. And that'll probably help enough in getting into this. And I did find the other verse. We're going to have that back in. So, Bill's question is, what do disciples have in mind when they're asking those questions? That's a tough thing.
Those two in verse 3.
Sure, in particular.
And end of the age.
Right. So, when are these things going to take place? Which is obviously the destruction of the temple. Obviously, because that's what they're just talking about. So, I think in the Jewish mind, in the first century, that temple is going to stand until the end. When this thing's destroyed, it's all over, kind of. In other words, the end of time and the end of that temple might very well be synonymous or the same time frame. Where it seems very clearly that Jesus is separating those two things, and that's kind of what I was trying to say. The first part looks like he's talking about this near fulfillment, which is going to have to do with the destruction of that temple and so on, and it's coming in that sense. But then he uses the same word after this switch in verse 36-37. For his coming as well after that, when he's talking about what appears to be the distant coming, the end of time, and so on. So what's in the disciples' mind seems to be conflated, and where Jesus kind of seems to be stretching them out, even though looking at them quite closely together at the same time as far as how he's talking about it. I don't know if that helps as far as thinking what they're thinking and what the answer might be. Good. So they ask about the coming of Jesus. Now there are lots of different words for certainly in Greek, for coming. Coming and going, and arriving, and things like that. Interestingly, in Hebrew there are quite a bit fewer words. And the word parousia itself, this Greek word, is not used in the Septuagint at all. The Greek translation of the Old Testament doesn't even use this word, except in some Greek parts. Some parts that are, you can see in the notes where they are, but not in the text that we would have, but in apocryphal books there are four uses of them, of that word. But that's the word they're using. That's the word that's coming out of their mouth. They're saying, okay, Jesus, what's the sign of your parousia? What's the sign that you're going to come, you're coming, and of the end of the age? And, you know, you might ask questions, well, what's the relation? That's kind of what Bill's asking. What's the relationship between the sign of your coming and the end of the age and the destruction of the temple and the end of the age and the end of what age? The end of the whole world or the end of a particular period of time? Which is, I think, is what Jesus is after as well. This time is ending. This Jewish time, this time of the law and of the temple and of sacrifices is coming to an end. I'm going to end it. And then I'm also getting in the whole shebang when it comes down to it at the end of time as well. So all that's, I think, in view here. So they ask about his coming, the sign of his coming specifically. And down in verse 26, if you want to move down there, in fact, 25 here. See, I told you beforehand. Look, I told you beforehand. Keep it. If they're looking for it, they say, hey, listen, here's Christ. He's come. He's in the inner rooms. Or here's Christ. He's come. He's out in the field. Then don't believe him. The Jesus coming is not going to be like that. Where maybe it was the first time. His first coming is like, look, he's in the inn. There he is as a baby. You can walk in and see him, right? There's a physicalness to that. Where Jesus says, it's not going to be like that when I come again. It's not going to be go here and see me and go there and see me. Rather, it's going to be like lightning across the sky. Right? You're not going to go anywhere to see him. He's going to show up and everyone's going to know it, which I think is the image of the lightning. And we get that in verse 26. So, if they say, look, he's in the wilderness, don't go out. They say, look, he's in the rooms, don't believe it. 27. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming, there's your parousia, of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. In other words, Jesus is saying, when this happens, you're going to know it. Everyone's going to know it. There's not going to be any question. You're not going to be seeking me out, maybe the way they sought him out or could have sought him out at his first advent. Okay, so there's one use of that the word right there, and that's kind of what we're pausing on, is that usage of it, but I want to show the other ways that Jesus uses it in the Olivet Discourse as well. But before I do that, before we look at the Olivet Discourse, which is kind of where we want to land and work with, I do want to give a little history of this word and get into it that direction as well. Yeah, Kim?
Did you say anything about verse 28?
Where the corpse is, the vultures gather? Yeah, I think it's the same way of like, and it has to do with the sky too. So the image of the lightning, it's like, okay, it's like splashing, it's obvious, this thing's something going on. And you know where the corpse is because you can see, I mean, it's obvious what's going on. It has, I think, to do with death and that kind of thing. It's like, you're going to know, it's going to be obvious when the bodies are strewn in Jerusalem what I've done. I think that's how it's taken. From a distance, you can see where the corpse is because of the circling vultures. Although the same word as eagles too. That's something kind of interesting thing about it too. So it could be where the eagles are, which might have a Roman connection, maybe. But, yeah.
I might be getting ahead of you, but so are you going in a direction of saying there was two parousias?
Or more.
Or more.
I think two mentioned in this text.
In this text, yeah. Right. The one at the destruction of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and then a second parousia,
yep.
which we're awaiting.
You bet. Which, and of course, they were awaiting both of them. At
right.
the time. But one's the near fulfillment of that parousia, and another the far fulfillment of that parousia. And one's certainly a non-physical visitation or presence, you know, to get at the word. But the other one appears to be very much a physical coming, too. So I think that's the difference between them as well. Plus, the signs are different. Here's this one that has these compacted signs that are coming right now. I told you beforehand. Here's this other one that's coming, and you don't know when it's going to come. I don't know when it's going to come. He says the Father knows when, and you better be ready. It's going to be a while. Right? So there are two different... Definite different pieces of advice. Commandments as far as how to approach the parousia, the coming, the presence of Jesus. So let's look at that word and see if we can't fill it out a little more. The word itself, like, kind of means presence, like someone who's here with you. Right? That's the kind of most basic meaning of the word. So let's flip to a couple of passages, and they're very, very simple to do. 1 Corinthians 16:17. If someone else wants to turn to 2 Corinthians 10:10, go for it. But you'll see they're all very similar as far as how the word functions, what it means. Here's Paul in 1 Corinthians 16:17. I rejoice at the coming of Stephanus and Portatus and Achaeus, because they have made up for your absence, for they have refreshed my spirit as well as yours. Give recognition to such people. Okay, so these people have come. Paul's saying, oh, it's good they've come. They've refreshed me because of they're here with me. Right? That's the word parousia. They've come. Someone have the 2 Corinthians 10:10?
Yeah.
Bring it.
For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and right. his speech of no account.
Okay, so Paul's like not much to look at when he's around. He doesn't speak all that well, but when he's not with us, like by letter, he seems enormous. When he's present with us, when he's here with us, oh, he's just this funny little dude that doesn't talk all that well and looks funny and has bad eyes or something. Right? The idea is his physical presence there is not impressive, where in writing he could seem very impressive. But the idea of parousia there is his physical presence, his being with them. Philippians 2:12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but also in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So again, in this very simple sense of just being present, right? So I'll make a side comment here. There's a general use of terms and just the way terms are used. And sometimes words or phrases can become technical in the sense that they, within some kind of discipline, whether it's theology or physics or whatever else, it takes on a specific meaning, right? A highly specific meaning. It doesn't mean all these other things. It means something quite particular. We call those technical terms. So it's a term within this discipline that comes to mean something very specific. And so the word parousia, especially as you kind of read the scholars, they want to present it as a technical term in the New Testament. And it is kind of, but it isn't in all these cases. Right? In all these cases, it's just a general term. It doesn't have anything to do with the presence of Jesus or the return of Jesus or the second coming or any of those things that are kind of brought into that technical term when it's defined. These are all common usages. And I'll blow you one bigger. It kind of makes it a little more interesting and fuzzy. Is that the person who uses the most, who uses the term the most, and talks the most about it, is Paul, the Apostle Paul, in his earlier writing, mostly. The term's not found in Revelation. That's kind of a mind blower, right? You think, oh, that'd be the place for it. This is even the term Revelation is a revealing of Jesus Christ, which has to do with his presence and his judgment and his salvation and all the things that are tied in with parousia, but the word's never mentioned, which is, like I say, a little bit of a mind blower. Paul uses the term, if I've got my numbers right in my head, 11 times. I think 6 of them in a non-technical way. Right? So we're looking at this word that kind of has some wraparound meanings of just kind of normal presence or coming or someone walking in the door. And that's the kind of central meaning of it. And then it takes on more particular meaning, especially in Paul's hands, half the time. And also here in Jesus and his apostles, where they don't need to say anything except, what's the sign of your coming? Right, that's all they have to say. And Jesus says, well, this is the coming of the Son of Man is going to be like lightning flashing from one side to the other of the sky. So that's the kind of technical, specific usage of it. The general definition is presence or just coming, arrival, advent. I'd want to use the Latin that would come across as the same thing. Then arrival, someone's presence, someone coming to you. Yeah,
it'd be more technical. Obviously, they're talking to him. He's right there, and they're saying, "Boy, you're coming." What?
Yeah.
Right here.
For sure, right.
So it's more technical, it sounds like.
Oh, you bet. And that's a good point. So when's your coming? He's standing right there. It's something worth thinking about, you know, as far as what that means, because it already happened. Here I am. And Paul, as far as I know, the New Testament doesn't use the word parousia for Jesus' first coming. It uses other words that are kind of, you know, similar anyway. Epiphany is one of them, which is like a showing. We get epiphany from that word in English. The showing of Jesus, which is to say his first advent, his first coming. So you can tell just by there are words that we use, whether in English now or long term in Latin or in Greek in the ancient church and in the Eastern church. There are kind of terms all over the place around this Jesus' return. What is Jesus talking about his coming here, about his parousia? So let's take another step. We got the general meaning, which is clearly on the pages of the New Testament, of just arrival or physical presence or a person being there. But we also go back, and this word has kind of a fun meaning, where, kind of fun anyway, where if in the ancient Greek world, if the emperor or if a governor or some, you know, dignitary, some bigwig was going to come to town or come to the area, they would have a parousia. They would come out and welcome this dignitary, and sometimes they'd even like strike coins and stuff to commemorate. For instance, I can't remember the date, but one of the emperors visiting Corinth. They struck coins. It's the parousia of the emperor at Corinth. And they come out to meet him and bring him back into town, and there were like lots of taxes levied to try to pay for this thing. But it's a big deal, right? It's a big party and something, you know, you can imagine President Trump coming to town, Portland, say. Yeah, maybe it's a bad idea. Well, anyway, a town that would like him a lot. Or it might work this way, negative parousia. Anyway, people coming out to greet and then bring him back in, the dignitary. And that would be a big deal for the city to have, or the area to have that kind of heavyweight coming. So the word, is in the technical term that way also, in the ancient world was that. Is a dignitary coming and the people coming out together to bring him into the city and welcome him in. And you can like kind of think about that a little bit with, in terms of like rapture, or going to church, being caught up in the air to meet Jesus, and then quite possibly, coming down with him, welcoming him to this earth, saying, okay, well, you come, and now, you know, we're recognizing you're our king, and you're arriving, as opposed to being raptured and being continued up with him, where he kind of comes down and picks us up, and then goes back to heaven for 7 years while there's tribulation, as per a premillennial scheme of things, or particularly a dispensational one. But, so that's the word parousia, then, has that as a background. It doesn't mean that that's what it means when you read it, but there's that in the background of the word when it's being used here. Yeah, Kim? Yeah.
In hindsight, we know they didn't know that he was going to die and resurrect and come back that way, because they were devastated when he died. So I'm wondering if this is more what they were thinking is, like,
right.
Okay, when are you going to become king or something?
Sure, you would think like triumphal entry kind of thing, right?
Right.
You know, that kind of thing where everyone's hooping up and hollering, the son of David's coming in, this and that. So it's probably, that's probably what's in mind a little bit of this parousia. Oh, he's coming in. Is now the time? Is he going to do it now? You know, or when he's waiting, you know. So yeah, I think the disciples have all that in mind, and they're confused about how it's going to go, right? About what the order of things. We're still confused about the order of things. Still confusion reigns in eschatology. Other questions on that, the kind of general usage, or this kind of interesting technical usage of receiving a dignitary into town and what that might look like. The words also used of gods in the ancient Greek world where, like, anyway, letters around say that a god would show up and someone would be healed. The parousia of this god would have some kind of effect upon the people. It's used that way. It's used in venerable observances and rituals where the god would be present with the people who are worshiping. And now you can take that into a 1 Corinthians 10 situation where Paul says, hey, you know, it's not these idols you're really worshiping, it's the demons. And maybe showing a little bit about how spiritual parousia works. How spiritual things actually function, how God's made that to work, where people who don't know what they're worshiping, you know, Neptune, really are worshiping demons, and they're really having communion with, Paul says, you know, koinonia with, the same thing we have with Christ, they're having with demons. We like to think they have nothing, because that's all false and unreal, and we have koinonia with Christ, because that's true. But the thing is, they're both true. And I think Paul stresses that in 1 Corinthians 10. And even this word parousia is that way. Right? There's a parousia that these pagans have with their gods, or the gods have with these pagans. And that word's used that way as well. So that's a bit to chew on. Any questions just on that? This word for visitation, for presence? All right. Then the ancient Hebrew parallels, the third one down. So I've kind of skipped around the notes a little bit. I apologize for that. We had the simple definition up top, some technical definitions, the ancient Greek usage, and then the ancient parallels in Hebrew, like I said, because the Hebrew Bible, when it's translated into Greek, called the Septuagint, or LXX, which means 70, doesn't use the word at all. Right? So it's not a word that Hebrews would think of to talk about, or at least the Hebrews a couple centuries before Christ, down in Alexandria, would use to talk about God's coming. But there are plenty of phrases in the Old Testament that have to do with just this idea, like the day of the Lord, or the day of Yahweh. Yom Yahweh is the day of Yahweh. And it's one of those deals where when the day of Yahweh comes, it's really bad news for God's enemies, and it's salvation for God's people often. Sometimes it's like bad news for God's people if they're the ones who will turn out to be the enemies of God and so on. But it's a day of rigorous judgment and God's like action in time, as opposed to kind of the regular days where it doesn't seem like we get a lot of that or something. Right? But the day of Yahweh, or the day of wrath, is another one. There are a number of handles in the Old Testament as far as a day of visitation, a day when God's going to come in judgment and salvation. And I think all that's built into parousia, but the word's not found like that in the Old Testament, if that makes sense. So we have parallel ideas in a lot of ways in the Old Testament, but not parallel terminology. So that makes it a little more difficult to kind of track down the biblical or Hebrew kind of mentality of what's going on here. It makes it easier to track off into ancient Greek thoughts. Oh, they have the word over here a lot. It presents an uneven way of studying the word, which is kind of unfortunate as far as it goes, because it doesn't seem so much to me, as I've kind of been waffling through this, wading through, I should say, all week, that it seems to me the Hebrew background to it, the day of the Lord and that sort of thing, is far more important to the meaning of the parousia of Jesus than a mere visiting of a dignitary or something like that, or some other way that the Greeks might have used it. Okay. Any questions before we move to that last section? So kind of the technical use in the New Testament, looking at how it's used in the New Testament, particularly in Matthew. Yes?
So you use the word Yom as the day of the Lord. That's another, I mean, just about any word, but that one too, they talk about a 24-hour day, they're talking about an age, oh, good. Time. I mean, they had an understanding, and we only have a smattering of understanding.
Yeah, see that. So the word Yom is like the same word in day one, day two, day three of the creation account. And people argue, and I think rightly so, with the ordinal numbers, first day, day one, second day, that every time in Hebrew we find that, it's always a 24-hour day. But the word day itself, just like in English, it's the day of whatever. It might just mean it's an era of or a time period of. In other words, the day of the Lord might be longer than 24 hours. Just the word itself doesn't tell us that. But when it's ordinarily numbered, first, second, third, in Hebrew, that's the case. They mean 24-hour days. That's one of the arguments for the 24-hour, you know, six-day creation, is the use of that word in that kind of context. In this kind of context, not the same, right? You wouldn't get, there's no literal day. It's the visitation. It's the parousia of God. It's the arrival of Him in all of that judgment on the one hand, but also salvation for His people on the other. So. Okay. Any questions? Last section then. This is kind of where we're getting into the meat of it. So look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 for an interesting double use of this word. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now let's read this section, and when we get to verses 8 and 9, you'll see coming and then the coming, right in verse 9. Those are both parousia. Now concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered together to Him, I'm not sure about that first coming there. By the way, let me give you just a little more. Like I said, there are a number of words that mean coming in Greek, but all the time you read coming isn't parousia, right? But there's enough overlap in the meaning of those words that it doesn't have to. Anyway, there's, you got to let the context speak for what that means, what coming is. More on that later. Concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered together with Him, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by spirit or spoken word or by letter seeming to be from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Now, we talked about this text a little earlier. The Thessalonians thought they had missed it. It doesn't say here, and it doesn't mean, and the tense doesn't mean, that they thought they were going to miss it. They thought they had missed it. Right? Paul says, no. So that ought to clue you in right now that Paul's not talking about the day when the mountains crumble and everything's, torched by fires. And it's like they didn't miss that. They didn't think they missed that. Nobody thinks they missed that. But they thought they missed something. Does that make sense? In other words, if we're taking the whole eschatological ball of wax and saying, oh, look, they thought they missed it, I think we make a mistake. But there's some part that they thought they already had missed. And that's the important part. Keep going. Number 3, let no one deceive you in any way, for the day of the Lord will not come, there's your day of the Lord, or the day will not come, unless the rebellion comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. Notice that man of lawlessness he picks back up later. Who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? There was something Paul told them, right? He taught them before. And you know what is restraining him now, so that he may be revealed in his time. Okay, so there's a restrainer of the man of sin or lawlessness is going on then. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains it will do so until he is taken out of the way. And when the lawless one, here we go, is revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the appearance of his parousia. Okay, so this one's going to be revealed finally in Jesus by the power and the power of his showing of his coming and the word of his powerful word is going to destroy. Verse 9, the coming of that's the parousia, of the lawless one is by activity of Satan and with all power and false signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing because they have refused to love the truth and so be saved. Okay, so I bring this passage up not to discuss the details of it, because I think we've discussed it a little bit before, probably not to anyone's satisfaction. However, the word parousia here, sometimes people want to say this word always means the coming, the physical presence of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what the word means, which it doesn't mean. It can mean that. That's certainly within the range of meaning, but it doesn't necessarily mean that every time you read it. And I think we have that going on here as well. Now, maybe there is a man of law, says a particular person, maybe a Caesar, maybe a high priest, maybe something like that, in Paul's own day with the Thessalonians, who is a man of lawlessness. He's already at work. There's something restraining him. It's going to be taken out of the way. It's all going on in Paul's time. And there's with that, there's a parousia of Jesus, who's going to come and wipe this the man of lawlessness out by the word of his power. But there's also a parousia of the man of lawlessness. There's a presence of him. He's a person and so on, right? So, anyway, the word parousia here might very well have to do with the presence of somebody, the physical presence of them, but it certainly has to do with their action, their present action in the people's lives. And Jesus' present action is going to come and destroy the present action, or at least the future action from here, of the man of sin or lawlessness. So we have a parousia of the man of lawlessness, and we have a parousia of Jesus here, right in the same situation, fighting against each other with Jesus winning. Right? So just to use that to see how the term goes, it's not always for Jesus, not a bit. But it does have to do with at least a present active force. Somebody is doing something, and it's going on now. It's a present situation. So any thoughts on that passage and the use of parousia in it? It might not make anything like a whole lot clearer for you. That's okay, because that's what happens when you study. It doesn't always come down to fine little points and happy little definitions. But I want to show you here that the word usage is a little broader than the physical presence of a person, though even in this case it could involve the very physical presence of Jesus and the man of sin. But I don't think it necessitates that at all. I think the present action of Jesus and his current action among us and the word of his power and so on would be his parousia, which I think we're going to see in the 24th chapter of Matthew as well. That the physical presence is not necessarily what the word means, though it certainly encompasses that meaning. And even maybe you tend to lean that direction for the physical presence of a person or thing. Any questions on Thessalonians? Yeah. So,
refer to him as a man of lawlessness?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. As far as the word is anomia, nomos, law. Anomia is the man against the law, lawlessness. I'm not sure how, among ancient historians, Josephus being like a primary one right in the middle there, how Nero is seen. It's a good question. But my guess is that's kind of what's going on here in the second Thessalonians text. Back to Matthew 24. Let's look at the four uses of Matthew 24. And see if we can distinguish between what Jesus is saying with them, even though he's using the same word. And while you're turning there, that's one of the struggles we're having here in eschatology at all, is that using this one word is like a little paradigm for eschatology. You can say things in a certain way, and people's minds think of other things that are related. In other words, you can say, for instance, if we're arguing right, that parousia has to do with the coming of Jesus in that first century and the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, the destruction of the way of worship of the people of God to whom he had come, and they had rejected him. And they said, okay, well, you're not going to see me again until you see me coming on the clouds, until you see me coming in judgment. And that parousia is that coming in judgment, even though it's not a physical coming of Jesus. Yeah, we can use the same word and talk about the physical coming of Jesus in relation to it at the end of time. So that's trying to do the same thing. So remember, in verse 3, the disciples asked about the sign of his. What's the sign of your coming? What's the sign of your presence? What's the sign of your parousia? And he tells you that having Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that is the abomination of desolation, is the sign of his parousia. And it's not going to be like, oh, here's Jesus, and oh, there's Jesus, but no one has any question. This is what he's talking about. And I think AD 70 qualifies as far as an overall, you know, four-year-plus debacle and outright bloodshed and bloodletting of the people of, you know, Jerusalem. It counts. Everyone knew what was happening. Now, that doesn't mean Jesus was physically there. But it does mean that everyone knew what was happening. That's a parousia in that generation. Now, as we move down to verse 36, right? So I'd say the text divides in verse 35 to 36, 35 and before having to do with that generation coming, and then 36 and following having to do concerning that day and hour. No one knows. Okay, so the first one, I know, and I'm telling you, and I'm giving you signs, and I'm telling you beforehand, so pay attention. Concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. It's a weird Christological verse. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the parousia of the Son of Man. Okay, so think of Noah, right? Think of what's going on in the days of Noah. For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and in other words, had a normal, daily, normal life until the day comes, right? Until the judgment comes. Until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will the parousia of the Son of, be the parousia of the Son of Man. So this unexpected judgment, this unexpected being swept away in the judgment of God, especially after a period of time of just kind of normal stuff, normal eating, drinking, giving marriage, makes me think of that Arminian text in 2 Peter 3, right, where the people are saying, well, when's the word coming? You know, everything's been the same ever since. And he says, well, hang on. And that's your 2 Peter 3, 9, that God's not slack and his promises of mankind slackness and so on. But that's the idea. That same idea is at work here. Hey, God's going to do this thing. And it seems like he's not. It seems like our everyday life just grinds on and moves on day by day. But it's coming. And even like it was in the days of Noah, when maybe they had the preaching of Noah saying, hey, I'm building this huge boat out here. It's for salvation. Maybe you should get it. And they're like, ha ha ha, I'm going to go eat and drink and get married and give some kids in marriage. They're just moving along while this work of salvation in their midst goes. And then suddenly they're taken away in wrath. And Jesus says, that's how that day and hour is going to be as well. They'll be messing around, and you know, think of the parables of Jesus as we're going to get, you know, go through the rest of the chapter in the next one. Either the wise and silly virgins who don't bring enough oil, and the other ones do, or the master of the how the master goes, but the master slave who's like, hey, my master's gone, I can just kind of eat and drink and get drunk with the drunkards and mess around, and suddenly the master comes back. Right? That's the far off coming of Jesus, the parousia, which he calls it here. But he also calls the parousia before that demarcation, which may not be his demarcation, it might just be mine, in the text as far as the time frame. This near fulfillment, so we wait for it, hear the signs for it, you're going to see it coming, we see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, get out, I'm there, I'm coming, and there's this great light in east to west, everyone knows what's going on. But concerning that day and that hour, when I make my presence known, my parousia, right, it's going to be a surprise. No one's going to see it coming. It's not going to have signs leading right up to it saying, here it is, get out of the way. It's going to come fast. So be prepared. And that's the whole like rest of the chapters. Be prepared. Be at work because you don't know when the parousia is going to come. So you see they're quite different parousias, but there's the same word that links them both, linked to the same question that the disciples asked about the sign of his coming and of the end of the age. So his answer is kind of spread out. And the parousia word links both sides of it, interestingly. Tim?
So I might have missed it when you said this already, but were you saying that 2 Thessalonians verse is a near and far thing, or was you saying it was just referring to Jerusalem?
I kind of suspect it's a near thing, as far as the 2 Thessalonians meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Paul's talking about something around AD 70 issues in that generation. Right. I think that's what's going on there. The reason I brought the 2 Thessalonians text is just to show the word parousia is used both for Jesus and for the man of lawlessness. And that maybe that gives us some more mental room to work on that word. That's all. So then when it comes down to the Matthew 24 usage of it, the disciples ask about the sign of his parousia. He tells them the sign of it unequivocally. He tells them the sign of it is Jerusalem surrounded by armies. When you see it, don't get your tunic, get out. That's the sign, get out. Everyone's going to know it. Lightning flashes from the east to the west. When it comes to the parousia beyond that, no one's going to know it. The sun doesn't even know it. But it's like the case of Noah, where he's working, he's doing his thing the right way, and he's saving his family. Everyone else, they're just doing their thing, kind of making fun of him, and they're in a flash. They're taking a judgment. Okay, that's that kind of parousia. So we have these different things going on, different lead-ups to them, different signs of them, and so on, but the same word. Parousia, right? The presence of the Lord Jesus Christ, whether it be a physical presence, which I think we believe at the end that will be the case. He will physically come, bodily, even as we saw him taken away. But in this sense of his parousia in Jerusalem, a judgment upon the Jews, and of course the salvation of the church, because he's separating this new work of the temple, the people of God, the spiritual temple, from this the type, the ancient type of the body of Christ, the temple itself, which he took down, not one stone left upon another. And that was his parousia. That was his presence with, that is to say, his presence in judgment and in salvation in the first century. And also that mirrors out or looks out toward his presence, his judgment as it comes at the end of time as well, which will be the same sort of thing, judgment in his enemies and the salvation of his people. So, any questions as that kind of wraps up?
Verse 30 has the English words coming, talking about him coming in the cloud. Is that parousia, or is that a different word?
It's another one. It's Erechomai, down in verse 44 as well, if you kind of look at the same thing, I threw out one of the notes. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. If you're verse 44 there, which is, being verse 44 seems like it's tied into the far coming. But again, he doesn't use the word parousia there. He just uses Erechomai, right? Just a regular, normal word for coming. But again, they overlap. They don't. In other words, it's all kind of hazy how the words go. Just having a word and doing a word study doesn't really clear it out for you. But it gives you some place to put your feet and some toe holes. Yeah. Vicki, do you have a question? Or Karen or something?
Are you going to attack the big issue of how is it that the Son of Man did not know since he was God and man?
No.
And he had the divine nature and the human nature and all of it, and even Thomas Aquinas didn't get it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the Christological difficulty looking at the text. Like, okay, well, you know, what does it mean that the Father only knows and the Son doesn't know? And what does that amount to for single essence of God, that kind of thing, you know, trying to understand theologically and Christologically what's going on there. No, I don't want any more confusion this morning than I already got.
I'll be attacking at a later time.
At a later time, indeed. Some point. I'm not going to set any dates. Put it that way.
Only Father knows when.
So, any questions about the word parousia? Presence, advent, coming, all those definitions. And how it's used for Jesus. Yeah. So, what we're going to do then, I think, is from this word study, which is supposed to kind of slow the point, blast off back in the imagery and move forward kind of rapidly through the rest of the section here, the first, and then take another look at the second section of the all of the discourse, and say, okay, well, here's the near coming, here's the near parousia of the disciples, and what that means, and then how that reflects in the far eschatological view of the parousia, and then how we fit in the middle of that, because that's kind of what's going on. Right, we're kind of in the middle of when Jesus not only came the first time in the flesh, but came in judgment upon Israel, maybe comes in judgment different times in history, in the very same sort of way, where he's going to bring specific justice, you know, specific judgment in this context. We could rightly say, like Israel had for years and years and centuries, that that's the day of the Lord. That's the day when the Lord made himself known in power and judgment. It's like the parousia. It's the very same idea. Jesus making himself known and being present in that way, looking forward to his final coming, which we often call the second coming, but in this case it wouldn't be the second coming at all, it'd be at least the third, right? I mean, as far as it goes. So using the kind of terminology, second coming, we mean by the second physical coming. That Jesus came in the incarnation physically, and he's going to come in the end physically as well. In the middle, however, he's come in different ways. It's been a spiritual judgment, salvation sort of thing, not a physical coming. So once we mean the first and second coming have to do with physical comings, not with these other potential comings that we're talking about as we look at the text of Scripture, and there are plenty of them, it turns out. So, with that, let's close in prayer and approach unto the mountaintop of worship together.